My name is Bob Fiedler. I'm with the Reserve Officers Association, and I head up our Defense Education Forum. And we're very privileged today to be doing this program with the Brookings Institution, which has done so much work on this, particularly led by Michael Hanlon and Peter Singer. I will just say briefly, again, we're in the home of the Reserve Officers Association, our Minuteman building. We've been around for almost 100 years. We represent the Reserve Officers of the United States Uniformed Services, and it's a real pleasure to have all of you with us today. Please be sure to turn off all your phones. If anybody needs any further assistance, our staff is on the fourth floor. They'd be more than happy to help you at any time during the program. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Michael Hanlon, Senior Fellow of the Brookings Institution. Michael.
Thank you, Bob, and we're certainly grateful to have all of you here, grateful to the Reserve Officers Association and to all our participants in a Brookings working group that's been discussing issues of the defense industrial base as well as the broader subject of changing American defense strategy and budget for the last year, really for the last 2 years. And you'll see a certain representation of that working group today on our two panels. As you know, we're also honored to have Congressman Mac Thornberry coming in between the two panels to give the keynote address. I'm going to give a brief introduction here to our panel, to the concept of the day, and then we'll get on with remarks because, as you know, this is an action-packed day with a fair amount of boom, boom, boom because we only have about 50 minutes for each panel, and we want to involve you in the discussion as well. So what we'll do here is that after I briefly say a word of welcome and introduction for each of our panelists and a couple other words to frame the discussion, we'll then proceed and then have about 20 minutes or so for discussion before we have Congressman Thornberry. We won't have any actual breaks, and so please feel invited at any time, thanks to the generosity of the ROA, to get up, replenish your coffee. If you need a bathroom break, you feel free to do that because we're not going to give you any other breaks officially or as a group between now and noon. We have so much to do. I would like to introduce a panel that I think can be described as young and vigorous, and this is true regardless of whether they are relatively, you know, early in their career or even those who have been around a while with the freshness and vigor of their analysis that continues to this day. We have Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, who is seated, obviously, two to my right. We have Robert Hoffa, who's now running his own consulting firm, but a longstanding analyst at the Northrop Grumman Corporation and their analysis center, also a professor at a number of universities, including the Air Force Academy in Georgetown, after a distinguished 24-year career in the Air Force. To my immediate right, Peter Singer, who runs our 21st Defense Initiative at Brookings and is an expert on a number of new trends and technologies in warfare, including drones, a subject about which he has recently written. I should also give Mackenzie a shout-out for her Wall Street Journal op-ed of yesterday, which was very provocative and I think helps frame our discussion. One more broad word about our purpose today. We are trying to focus on the national security industrial base, the technology, science, research and development, infrastructure and capability, human and physical in this country that's so crucial to our technological excellence and supremacy, which is a core element of the American way of war and what gives our relatively small military an ability to play such an important role around the world. This has been, in general, in American defense policy, sort of an afterthought. The assumption being, well, we've always had great science, we've always had great industry, and we've always been able to assume that once we adjust our force structure, once we adjust our budgets, industry will sort of take care of itself, settle down, do whatever mergers and acquisitions it might need to, and continue to be there almost for the asking without the strength of the industrial base or the science base having to be an explicit concern of policymakers. I think that day has changed, and that is a premise behind our entire working group, as well as our working group's white paper, which we invite you to find down below where you walked in, but we'll also have some extra copies brought up here, and it's going to be on the brookings.edu website today as well. We don't have a lot of prescriptions as a group about which areas of technology, which areas of the industrial base require more support, require more attention, preferential help, and we certainly don't advocate subsidies in general, but just in terms of a matter of policy, which areas of defense industry, defense science are the most important. We don't take positions on these questions as a group, but we do share the common belief that the national security industrial base needs to be as vivid and as intense a subject of discussion as anything like a two-war strategy or a swing to Asia or a given nuclear posture or all the other subjects that we're used to debating in this town when we talk about and think about defense strategy. So that's the broad motivation. This first panel will focus a bit on the linkages between broad strategy and budget questions on the one hand with acquisition, modernization, and industrial-based strategies on the other. The second panel will get a bit more focused on the specifics of the national security industrial base. But we invite both panels and all of you, as you raise questions and concerns and comments, to feel free to blur the lines a little bit, because the general subject here is obviously going to have to be in a back-and-forth fashion. The defense budget is in such flux that it would make little sense to just assume we know where it's headed and build our national security industrial-based strategy or discussion around that set of assumptions. Everything's in flux, and so we're going to have to proceed accordingly. Let me just say one brief word now about my own thinking on this subject, then I'm going to turn things over to Robert, and we'll just work down the panel with roughly 8 to 10 minute presentations by each panelist, again, saving about 15 or 20 minutes for your questions before the congressman arrives. And I would just like to really frame things in very simple terms as I think about them. I've been working very hard in the last year on a book project where what I've tried to do is to shake up my own assumptions and break out of my own comfort zone about what kind of U.S. strategy adjustments I think are possible in an era when we have to downsize, we have to save money, really as a matter of national security policy, not just as a matter of the politics of the moment, but because our deficits have become so enormous and are contributing to an erosion of our long-term economic strength, which is itself necessary for national security. I think we have to view defense and the defense budget partly in these terms and view deficit reduction as a core element of defense policy. Now, we'll have different views on the panel about how far that logic should go, but that for me is a starting premise. And so I wound up coming up with a few different ideas, and I'm just going to tick about three of them off and then hand things off. I wound up arguing that, in fact, we do not need a two simultaneous land war capability anymore, that something like a one war capability plus two smaller missions, probably multinational but potentially long, is now an adequate basis for sizing the ground forces. And the ground forces perhaps can go down to their Clinton-era levels or even a little below. And indeed, it appears that that's where we're headed now with what we're hearing out of the Pentagon by way of early indications of where the president's budget and new strategy will head. I've also suggested the Navy do something that it has resisted in most of its combatant fleet for decades, which is called sea swap, the idea of actually having a ship stay overseas for a year or two and having the crews share the ship and replace each other after six-month deployments by being flown out to the theater rather than having the one crew always stay with the one ship. This allows for a more efficient use of the fleet and therefore allows for a somewhat smaller fleet rather than a larger fleet, perhaps consistent with our need to stay strong in the Western Pacific and the Persian Gulf. And also, just one more point on national security industrial-based policy, I argue for fairly major revamping and, frankly, scaling back of some big programs, including the F-35 and the Littoral Combat Ship. I'm not going to bore you with the details of my thinking there now, but I'm actually a little surprised that the Pentagon, by early indication, seems to just want to delay many of these programs and actually keep more of them intact than I would have thought prudent or possible at this moment. But the moral of the story, and the point on which I'll finish, is this. Even if you do all these things, or things like them, it's pretty hard to save more than $500 billion in the 10-year defense plan. Now, I'm not saying that that has to be the right number. For some people, that's already too much, and we may hear from one of them in a minute. For some people, that's not enough, and perhaps we could save more than that amount relative to previous plans. But what I'm saying is even doing this is hard. And when you actually do the arithmetic, you're going to have to make tough choices, in my judgment, about cutting muscle, not just trimming fat. And so that's the spirit in which we launched this discussion today. And without further ado, I will now turn things over to Robert. And again, we'll go Robert, Mackenzie, Peter, and then your questions. Sir.
Thank you, Michael. Ladies and gentlemen, pleasure for me to be here. Thank you for the Brookings team for the invitation. I expect many of you recall the quote that's often attributed to Winston Churchill. Gentlemen, we are out of money. Now we have to think. The U.S. Department of Defense, as the Brookings Arsenal of Democracy paper makes clear, is not out of money. But the defense budget we're learning just a little bit more about, seems like each day the FY13 budget, $535 billion, was it? We're hearing more about personnel cuts today in the Pentagon. And, of course, we all know that there is this targeted amount of somewhere around $500 billion that will be reduced from the defense budget over the next decade. And then there's this lurking sequestration of another perhaps $600 billion that could hit defense at January at this time next year. So thinking smarter about defense, as my colleagues in another think tank in town, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, like to say, certainly seems in order. So the paper that we present to you here today provides plenty to think about, with its particular focus, as Michael said, on the role and the future of the defense industrial base. And it sets out questions for the presidential candidates and their party platforms that provide a good outline for the prioritization of defense needs as plans and budgets once again try to avoid that perennial mismatch. In my brief remarks this morning, I'd like to focus on that first question that's outlined in the paper, that is how the sectors and the technologies should be prioritized to meet U.S. security needs in the future. This, you know, is just the sort of guidance that industry wants and longs for and often doesn't get in the so-called strategy documents, the QDR, the National Security Strategy, that are issued. There are always lots of worthy objectives, but rarely is there the kind of guidance that the industry can take to direct their own investments, to do their own strategic planning, to plan on their workforce and their facilities, and perhaps most importantly, provides them the stability that they want to see and their investors want to see as well. So let me start with just a brief background, move to the strategic guidance as we understand it's evolving that Michael alluded to, give you my own views on what I think the paper kind of stopped there. Let me suggest to you some priorities, some sectors, some systems that I think need to be supported in the future as we face these budget cuts, while noting the concerns of the industrial base as I go along. First, I hope you noticed the recommended reading list at the end of the paper, or that you will turn to that. A few of us up here are part-time academics, so we always like to add to the syllabus of reading material. One of those is a paper my CSBA colleagues Barry Watts and Todd Harrison wrote. They authored it on the U.S. industrial base. Their work characterizes the defense industrial base as a highly regulated industry. But with some irony, they note the reluctance of the U.S. government in the past to pursue a coherent long-term strategy for maintaining a healthy defense industrial base. As Jack Gansler has noted, the United States might be the only industrialized country in the world that does not treat its defense industrial base as a valuable national asset. Watts and Harrison in that paper call for a change to this policy, arguing that an industrial-based strategy, at the very least, should ensure the preservation and the advancement of those few sectors that are critical to the future security of the United States. So that begs the question, which of these sectors are critical and worthy of specific government intervention, investment, motivation to the industry to ensure that those capabilities are available when they're needed? If you want to search for answers to those questions, what sectors are most important, we certainly can be helped by what guidance has been issued by the U.S. government. And two documents that have hit the street lately, I think, are helpful in this regard. The first of those was the document from DOD called Priorities for 21st Century Defense. And the second one, which you may not have seen, was a Joint Chiefs of Staff document called the Joint Operational Access Concept. Both of those documents make a very strong case for U.S. forces in the future to be able to operate in what we've known to become as A2AD, anti-access area denial environments, under the contention that the way U.S. forces have operated over the last decade have been in relatively permissive environments. But as we look to future contingencies and adversaries, that condition will probably not hold. So we need to think about a force that has to penetrate, loiter, accomplish its missions in arenas that are far more contested, in environments that are far less friendly. If you want to read between the lines a little bit in those somewhat politically correct documents, or also look at some of the other work that's been done here in town on what the principal security threats that the United States does face in the future, it usually comes down to about three. The first remains terrorism, and I think we are seeing a switch from a counterinsurgency to a counterterrorism strategy. That's the nexus of radical Islam and transnational terrorism with the potential for state failure across the Islamic world. Secondly is China. That's the rise of a major strategic competitor in the Western Pacific that threatens U.S. and allied interests there. And third, what we used to call rogue states, I don't know what the current term of art is, but that implies the armed aggression of a rogue state, that's North Korea and Iran, that may have nuclear weapons to back up their own power projection in very strategic regions, again, for the United States, and along with the possibility of nuclear proliferation from those states. Well, if you look at those contingencies in the future, then the force planner's perspective becomes one to develop the force structure and the capabilities that will be sufficient. And force planners always err on the side of conservatism. We always want more, perhaps, than the budgeteers allow us. But you want to have the capabilities to prevail, to meet the mission in each one of those contingencies as you design them. Budgeteers, on the other hand, might see the same problem, but they'll look for savings across those three. They'll look for commonalities. What are the kinds of systems that we can use to swing among those contingencies so we can invest and know that whatever that future might be, we'll have those kind of capabilities at hand. So let's look, as I've done, we won't do that in detail, at the hypothetical contingencies that we face containing China, deterring and defending against rogue nuclear armed states, and countering terrorism. What are the common capabilities, systems, platforms that we need to have, regardless of how that future might unfold, but with an eye very distinctly focused on what those adversaries might attempt to do over the next decade? As you do that kind of analysis, several capabilities come to the fore. The first of those is long-range non-nuclear precision strike, systems and platforms that can penetrate anti-access air denial environments. Dominate the enemy defenses across the domains. That JCS paper talks about cross-domain synergy in space, in air, on land, and at sea. You want to be able to defeat the enemy defenses. C4ISR and robust battle networks, you've got to be connected. You've got to have the intelligence and reconnaissance in order to have a picture, situational awareness of that battlefield, whatever it is. Unmanned vehicles still seem to work in almost every occasion. We've seen them in low-intensity conflicts. They will remain important, as Peter Singer has written about, in high-intensity conflicts as well. Missile defense becomes important. Electronic attack, an edge that the United States military has held for a long time and must continue to do so. We all know about cyber deterrence and defense, hard to talk about, but the United States is under attack every day in cyberspace. And then ultimately, or finally, capacity building, we used to call it burden sharing, getting our allies, whether it's at the high end or the low end of conflict, to aid us in these missions. Have we ever tried such an approach before, outlined the kinds of things that we needed and said this is where our investment priority should lie? Yes. And in fact, the Watts-Harrison paper, they recollect a time back in early 2001 in which a very similar kind of proposal was offered in the Department of Defense, but it, as you can imagine, fell victim to bureaucratic politics. It also fell victim to a policy of plenty. As 2001 events unfolded and the United States launched on overseas wars, the defense budget, as we all know, expanded, doubled since then. So hard choices did not need to be made. That's not the case today. As threats, as we wind down our budgets, seem to be waxing rather than waning. As we think about taking down the defense budget and prioritizing among it, we want to keep in mind, the next panel perhaps will focus more precisely on that, on the health of the defense industry. And after all, that's why we gathered to produce this paper. So even if you can prioritize and lend guidance and give stability to the industry to provide these capabilities, it's still incumbent on the government as part of its industrial-based strategy to consider some mitigating measures to ameliorate the impact of defense cuts on the ability of these individual companies to provide the capabilities when they're needed. There's a list of these measures in a very good paper that was produced in a letter that was sent to Secretary Panetta, led by the Aerospace Industries Association. I would add that one to your reading list as well. But it includes a long list of continuing industry requests of the government, such as risk sharing, reducing compliance burdens, approving multi-year acquisition for key programs, and implementing export control reform, which goes into that capacity building category. I recommend that paper to you as well. In closing, thanks to the Brookings team for inviting me to participate both in the larger study effort and in the presentation of the paper today. One last reading recommendation. Michael already alluded to his book on the Wounded Giant, which he subtitles America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. I told him industry didn't really like that word austerity, but he used it anyway. But there's a thing about austerity that we need to keep in mind. Austerity is not scarcity. The defense budget is not scarce. It has ample resources, but we are being asked, the government is, and industry is listening, to prioritize those resources. Austerity implies a choice. So I think when it comes down to, well, what questions should presidential candidates be addressing in terms of the nation's security and particularly the nation's industrial base, it's how much should the Defense Department be paying to bring down the deficit? That's a choice in terms of austerity. And when it comes time to make those choices, I hope they will consider the future challenges that face the United States and the prioritization of those key capabilities that will allow the United States to meet those security challenges in the future.
Thank you very much. Before we go to Mackenzie, one quick clarifying question, and again, a nuanced point, but I think just for the sake of putting the conversation right to a clear focal point, implicitly it sounded to me like you were saying that there were a number of areas of technology that are perhaps not unimportant, but can be viewed as somewhat less important than the ones you mentioned, and then maybe perhaps we've even sometimes assumed in the past. And if I was going to do a quick list, it would include things such as nuclear forces, short-range tactical combat aircraft, certain Army ground systems for traditional ground combat. Is that a fair way to begin to delineate not what you would say are low priorities by any means, but priorities that may be just a notch down from the top tier?
I think they could be put a notch down. If you look at what the future requires, it appears from those strategic documents, the requirements aren't as great for those systems that you talked about.
And over to you, Mackenzie, to respond any way you wish.
Okay, thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. There's plenty of seats up here for those who want a chair, just so you know. Feel free to sit in the reserved, and we'll find space elsewhere. It was the perfect panel that Michael put together, like usual, and thanks for having us, because Bob is focusing on question number one in our paper, and I'm going to jump right to the last one, which is number 10, where the working group posed a question to policymakers, which includes those running for president on the Republican side, the candidates seeking to win the primary nomination, but also those who currently serve in policy positions in government, because DOD is not immune in the need to answer these questions either, and those who lead the country now. But basically, the key question Michael asked in my mind is, what's needed to ensure U.S. military technological supremacy in the years and decades ahead? And it's the key question, and actually Bob laid the terrific foundation for a lot of these answers in terms of particularly his capability set and identifying and prioritizing that. I agree with Bob. Industry continues to have little to no guidance from the department. This is not exclusive to this administration. Most of the comments I say actually go back across party lines here in the last 15 years, even the last actually 20, 25 years as well. And to have these, to put it out there in stark terms in black and white, this is more important than that, are the kind of true sort of, quote, hard choices DOD likes to talk about, but which we often don't really see when it comes to when I consider prioritization. It's hard. It's hard for Congress to agree on prioritization because it means winners and losers. And in this town, we don't like to do that. It's just like your kid's softball team. I mean, Washington is very similar in terms of, everybody's a winner, and that's actually not the case. In terms of how quickly and steeply budgets are coming down, the sky is not falling, but it's certainly a sea change ahead. And this is not a build down like others. And, in fact, Michael's written on this in the past. I've borrowed some of his research from foreign policy, examining historical defense build-downs, not just in the U.S., but in other nations as well. We're pretty good at the build-downs. We're pretty predictable in doing them. We've, for a loose term here, we've disarmed after every conflict in the last century, and we're set to do that again. Disarms, again, a loose term. I don't think we'll fully do that this time around. But the unique part about the current build-down in our defense budgets is that, you know, we do still have 70,000 U.S. forces in Afghanistan. It's not clear that we won't have to continue to work with Iraq in a military capacity, even though we're not there at the moment. The country is not doing so hot without U.S. forces there. We all know Iran is continuing to pose problems, and all of the other, you know, things around the world that the U.S. military is doing aren't going away. The dramatic increase in counterterror missions in Somalia and Yemen and Latin America, for example, all of these things are going to continue. The building partner capacity to prevent conflict in the future and help our allies and friends sustain the capability so we don't have to intervene. There's a backlog of demand in DOD, and yet the budgets are coming down as if there isn't. And so this is a unique period in history in the build down. We have a sense of what DOD is coming, and their answer to question number 10, you know, the securing supremacy for the future. And they've picked up a lot of the right terms and buzzwords from people like us up here who care about these issues and follow these issues. So, for example, you see it on everything from their decision to lay off 100,000 active duty ground forces under the banner of reversibility, right? If we get this wrong, don't worry, everybody. We'll figure it out and we'll rebuild. And it's called we'll just yank him back from the reserve component and put him back in the active. And it's not a problem, so don't worry, nothing to see here, which I actually don't think that's the most viable solution. It's a budget-driven one, I understand. But then on the DOD procurement and R&D side of the budget, the accounts we're talking about primarily up here, the solution in the buzzword capacity has been innovation. And Peter is the expert on this panel to talk about how that is happening in terms of robotics and other specific areas of the defense budget. But on the high end, on the whole cloth, what I'm telling you is that's not there. And the emperor has no clothes. When you pull back the terms and then you put the line items, you match and rack and stack the numbers and see what we're actually buying in terms of that term of art, there isn't much there. Again, partly but just due to budget-driven decisions, but not entirely. I know, for example, we can talk about the Air Force, next-generation bombers. One of the few things that's going to survive these budget announcements coming later today. But this is a really small pot of money right now. I mean, we're talking a couple $100 million. It's in an embryonic stage as a program right now. And what we're seeing and where the Air Force and where the department writ large, because the Air Force does take a lot of its orders from on high, where the Air Force goes with this program is indicative of this larger challenge of innovating for the future and truly modernizing with a new capability. And when I say modernizing, this is a term of defense nerds care about, but it actually means something in light of what we're talking about in sustaining the human capital, the research infrastructure, the training of scientists and engineers and designers and machinists and welders, all of the types of people, the infrastructure, et cetera, all the things that go into making something that we're talking about leads to this industrial base, obviously, benefit. So the term modernization is important to draw this distinction. You hear a lot of the times the services say we need to reset or recapitalize after 10 years of war, particularly the ground forces. And a lot of times what they mean is to take the vehicle we have, set the engine back to 0 miles, put more neat, nifty things that are brand new, commercial off the shelf, into the cockpit or in a vehicle's case, in the driver dash, et cetera, and give everybody neat stuff. But you're still basically driving around the same frame. If you look at, for example, fifth-generation fighters or even our very experimental next-generation destroyer, both of these are systems that not only the internal guts of them are, have a lot of neat, brand new things. Not all the, in all cases, but have a lot of neat and interesting things on the inside. But also, what you find is in these types of hulls and frames for the aircraft or the ship, in this case, is that the modernized system is truly built from the ground up. So, for example, the Stealth and the fifth generation fighter, as I've been told many times going to Fort Worth, is built into the frame. So while you can do amazing things with Lockheed and Boeing's older fourth-gen aircraft, it's still never going to be the same as a fifth-gen because there are certain things that you cannot do structurally to an airframe to change it. Same thing with the DDG-1000. You may like it, you may not. It's not the point. But when we're talking about comparing an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, even a Flight 3A, you know, brand-new, modernized, open system, Aegis open architecture, et cetera, all of the things that we're changing on the internal components of that, the DDG-1000 still has the radar cross-section of a rowboat. And a 51 will never have that, because we're building it from the ground up. It's a whole new, brand-new thing. So this is the term modernization, and this is where DoD has absolutely no answer for the future, not on the low end, not on drones necessarily, and not on robotics, not even on some particular capabilities like nanotechnologies, solid-state lasers, et cetera. These all need bolstering as well, but I'm talking, again, on the high-end major systems. We're still pretty much living off the Reagan military here in the case of this type of modernization. So maintaining our supremacy for the next, I would say, 20 years, since that's, you know, that's a good time frame for DoD to think in terms of, although I know that's also hard to do, the first thing we have to do is look at what DoD buys and the tool sets, as Michael laid out in question number 3, to evaluate whether or not they're capable of doing this. Do they have the tools to evaluate this stuff and access to those industries that can help them do this in the future? Even if they're not doing it today, can they do it tomorrow? If you walk around town or if you read legislation like the McCain-Levin bill, the Weapons Acquisition Reform Act that passed a couple years ago, and even the House Armed Services Committee put together an acquisition panel, I mean, everybody in town has a solution to acquisition reform, which is needed, but the challenge is this is something that's plagued every Secretary of Defense and every administration since, well, the end of World War II, or since I can remember in modern history. It seems to have only gotten worse, and we really have only piled on the solution set as opposed to go and take things out and put more things in. But what the real challenge here is, legislation like McCain-Levin, for example, and I will pick on them in particular, it tends to focus on what DoD buys on its hardware side. And something we've talked about in this group, DoD buys a lot of stuff, more than probably anybody else in the world, any given annual year. Let's use the 2010 defense budget as a metric. Close to $700 billion when you include the war spending. About $400 billion of that bought stuff. It's a lot of money. Not, you know, paid people or anything like that, or paid for training, et cetera, just bought stuff. Well, more than half of all the stuff DoD buys are services, IT, and commodities. And all of our solution sets, which tend to be wrong, are focused on the minority funding pot of goods, hardware, kick the tires, tangible things you can touch and feel. And we continue to pile on not just the red tape and the bureaucracy, including the acquisition, the overwhelming acquisition bureaucracy, DoD workforce, but all of the solutions that tend to come into that pot of money that make the system actually more risk-averse in many cases. It's focused exclusively on things that we buy that you can touch. And we're not talking about this other pot of money, which, frankly, is ripe for solutions and is ripe for actually being a bill payer for things that we need to buy. Because right now there's a great need to buy hardware. And I would argue, if I was adding an annex to Michael's book, there's probably less of a need or at least an ability to give up a little bit on that services, IT, and commodities, particularly since so much of the commodities was related to war spending, things that you actually needed to prosecute operations overseas. So we are losing our edge now. This is not a problem for 2 years from now. We're actually losing our technological margins of superiority across the services and across the domains on the high end today. And the fact that we're not even acknowledging that there is a problem means that it's getting worse more quickly. Congress doesn't, if no one's telling Congress that this is a problem, then they don't have any solutions and they're not going to think about it. And they're certainly not going to direct money towards it if no one's saying this is actually a problem. I would echo Bob's sentiments from CSBA. We've had no coherent long-term defense industrial base strategy, and I would agree with that. But more specifically, what DOD lacks for the services, intra-service and inter-service, are long-term R&D and S&T plans specifically, and then a fit if that budgets towards that year after year. And I mean something much more granular than a 30-year shipbuilding or aviation plan. Right, something that's much more linked to these line items in the budget and capability sets that we say that are needed to buy. So why are we losing our edge now? It's not just a function of a lot of the problems that I've talked about already, but it's also because our missed decade of modernization, defense budgets, back to the Wall Street Journal, defense budgets have grown pretty significantly in the past decade. Nobody disputes that, but they grew for a reason. And a lot of that reason is because they were cut so deeply the decade before. And a lot of that money went straight into wars or things related to them. So what you saw was a procurement budget and an R&D budget, the things that, help build and buy what we need. Those were pretty big pots of money. But they were going to very specific current day problems and not to the future. But we mortgaged the future in the last decade. So now we're going on 21 years, 22, depending on the budget timeline we're talking about, of continuing to pay for the today at the expense of the future on the high end. I'm most worried about the R&D investments, the research and development investments, and planning for defense budgets right now in this build town. Now, I don't necessarily want to see a return to, the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, where DOD, basically the Defense Department's research and development led the entire U.S. government and, frankly, the commercial sector economy's R&D efforts. But there is something to be said for the incredible synergy and the spin-off effects for all of us, even in this room, that we don't think about every day, that due to DOD's research and development efforts that have helped the military and helped the wider U.S. economy as a result. So we know the obvious things. We all have access to the Internet today because of the military. You have GPS in your car because of the military. You have a microwave in your kitchen because of the military R&D. Those are pretty straightforward ones. But there's a whole lot more, many, many more other things, like, for example, the airplane that you might fly to go home for Christmas and see your family, the Boeing 707, for example, is a derivative of an originally designed military aircraft. Digital photo, you probably have a camera or it's in your phone. Your digital photography, thanks to the U.S. military. Radar, a lot, again, your pilots use to fly you home for the holidays, but not just on aircraft, lots of capabilities. My son's baby video monitor has night vision. That's thanks to the U.S. military. And then finally, anybody who's lucky enough to have an iPhone 4, if you have Siri, that's thanks to the U.S. military. That's artificial intelligence. It came from DARPA, which was a result of R&D investment in the defense budget. So these are just some examples of things that are needed. I don't advocate spending money in DOD that we don't need, that's for sure. But all of these things, these innovative programs of the future, again, the purpose of them was to develop the human capital, the research infrastructure, the manufacturing industrial base behind that, and that also leads to things like foreign sales, which help our U.S. economy, and do things like, again, training the personnel, scientists, machinists, engineers, designers, et cetera. All of these benefits then lead to technology transfers among companies within working for a military customer, among companies working across the U.S. government. Obviously within the commercial sector itself. What we're not seeing right now is the Defense Department look up and talk about the capability sets that are needed. As we see precision-guided munitions proliferate, as we see stealth become increasingly less effective against enemy air defenses and other types of capabilities and as they develop their own, we don't have these long-term R&D S&T plans. We don't have answers for how we're going to build a next-generation surface combatant, how we're going to build, for lack of a better term, a sixth-generation fighter. How are we going to invest in laser, nano, and fiber technologies and all the things that I think Peter will talk about? And so I guess the answer to the question in conclusion is, are the policy interventions necessary to sustain our preeminence? Yes. But it's like a good old classic 12-step program. Till DOD and Congress actually understand that the answer to number 10 right now is we're losing it, we're losing that preeminence, and there's actually a problem to be fixed. I fear any prescriptions Bob and I come up with are hopeless at this point, not to be too dire or draconian, but we have to admit that there's a problem first.
Thank you, Mackenzie. And Peter, over to you.
Thank you. One of the things that I think is so special and frankly so neat about this project and the working paper is that you have folks from very different perspectives, very different backgrounds, very different organizations, very different political stripes coming together in that paper. Identifying what we've been able to do is jointly identify what we all collectively think are the key issues and identify the key questions that we think any and every candidate who aspires to national security leadership and or current official in that space needs to be able to answer. We may disagree about the answers to those questions, but we agree that they all need to face those questions. And so that's really what the goal of the effort is to try and push these important issues into the discussion. As Mike said, too often they're left as an afterthought. The goal of this project is to force them into the discussion because all of us collectively, from right to left, agree that they're important. It's interesting. I was going to make 4 points, but I want to quickly make a fifth that builds off of everybody sort of jumping on which question they think is the most important one out of this. Mackenzie talked about all the different benefits that R&D on the military side has had to our nation. You left out my favorite example, which is actually the fluoride in your toothpaste came from Office of Naval Research because good dental health is the key to naval superiority. But I actually think question number 8 really is the answer to much of this because, frankly, whether you're talking about the manufacture of that jet aircraft that's a passenger jet to Siri, it's not whether we spend on R&D for it that benefits our nation and our national security complex in the long term. It's whether we capture the long-term benefit of it to our workforce, to our economy. Siri's great, but I would point you to the wonderful in-depth report that New York Times had this weekend about how we haven't been able to capture the benefit for our economy from Apple. We paid for Siri. We ain't getting the benefit from Siri. But four more focused defense points. The first is the halcyon days of defense spending at a big level are gone. Figures show a cold, hard reality that we often want to ignore. And so as the token liberal intellect at this panel, I have to quote Aristotle, numbers are intellectual witnesses, as he said. And today the numbers that make up America's fiscal house are screaming. You all know those numbers. Our debt stands at roughly $15 trillion, roughly 100% debt-to-GDP ratio. If we don't take action within a couple of decades, we get to over 300% GDP ratio. The numbers make modern-day Greece rather than ancient Greece look like a haven of financial stability compared to where we're headed. We face a national security crisis when it comes to our economic security situation. Bottom line, that's a reality. There's no ignoring it. Now, the sensible and I would argue patriotic response of the political parties would have been to disdain each of their extremist wings whose intransigence got the nation into this position and focus on coming to the common ground with the still needed reforms in both tax and entitlements that are actually driving this economic situation. Unsurprising to most anyone who's watched these parties at play over the last decade, that's not what happened. The various players were unable to come to agreement, and we now face the proposition of not just cutting a little over $400 billion now, but potentially another $500 billion coming. That's not my point, though. My point is this. The numbers don't lie. Even a $1 trillion cut in the defense budget would only cut a small percentage off of that growing mountain. And the parties and the players are still the same. So we often want to talk about this defense cuts as a one-time only thing. We'll make it through sequestration and or don't let sequestration happen, but just it's that's it. The reality is that we're going to have to get used to wrestling with how to face debt more than once. It's not just a 2012 issue. And exploring cutting the defense budget is going to be on the table more than once again, beyond that first wave that we're experiencing right now. Now, again, as someone who supports a strong defense, I wish this wasn't the reality. I'm not advocating it for to be the reality. I'm just pointing out the fact the numbers are there. We need to prepare for that. Point number two, a lot of people talk about strategy, but one of the things that strategy truly is about making hard choices. We've had a great quote from Churchill, and I see some of our friends here from the British Embassy. Strategy at the start of World War II was not saying we're going to put all our resources into fighting both the Germans and the Japanese in the Pacific and the Indo-Burmese theater. The strategy that they laid out at the start of the war that was true strategy that won the war was, guess what, Germany first, then Japan, and Indo-Burmese theater last. It's not about wishful thinking. So when you're setting priorities, you also, and Mike tried to push this, have to identify what you're not going to do. And that's very hard for those of us collectively in this town. It's also about having a sense of where you are now and where you want to go to next. And so all the attention that'll come out today with the release of the budget is about which aircraft, which tank, which ship to cut. But what's more important to me is figuring out if we have any principles behind those cuts, because, again, it's not a one-time-only deal. The principles, the underlying manner that we think about going about the cuts is more important to me than what specifically is in cutting. So I wanted to lay out in my final 2 points two principles that I think we need to have into the discussion and I think will help us in developing that strategy. The first is Sutton's Law. The bank robber, Willie Sutton, was asked why he robbed banks, and he famously replied, because that's where the money is. And McKinsey hit this point really well, that too often in discussions of defense budgets, national security, industrial base, cuts, et cetera, we focus on acquisitions in terms of specific items, specific programs, basically widgets. That's the equivalent of planning to rob a drugstore when the bank is next door. We need to focus on, for example, the fact that for every 30% the military spends on buying weapons, we spend 70 cents on maintaining those same weapons. Or the balance between goods and services, where by my numbers, for every 45 cents that the Pentagon spends on buying goods, the Pentagon spends 55 cents on contracting out billable hours of services from defense firms. And yet our acquisition system is not set up for that. In fact, our response to some of the worst losses, the worst contract abuses, was to load up on acquisitions officers back in D.C., where most of the losses were actually happening out in the field in contingency operations. Similarly, we spend about $80 billion a year on installation expenses. The problem of owning, running, powering, and cleaning the world's largest portfolio of real estate. We clearly can come about that a lot better. But one that is rarely talked about, and as far as I understand, will not be dealt with in the upcoming budget, is personnel and benefits, which is basically doing to the defense budget what is happening to our larger national budget as a whole. Its growth is basically squeezing everything out. The cost of providing health care has roughly tripled in the last decade, while the overall amount of spending on personnel is about a third of the Pentagon's budget. And if this growth doesn't stop, at a certain point, a couple decades from now, we get to a position where the Pentagon budget actually doesn't buy any weapons. It just pays for personnel and benefits. And yet, we treat it like a political third rail. We just don't want to touch it. It's simply not mentioned and not being dealt with right now. Brookings is going to be issuing a report on this in a couple of days, actually written by Carl Gringrich, who's our Army Federal Executive Fellow. And it points out how we can find savings in personnel and benefits of a scale of at least $100 billion, importantly, without breaking the commitments that we've made to folks. I know I'm in dangerous ground right now and you're talking about this, but in this room in particular. But the point is we can't keep treating this like a political third rail. We have to maintain our commitments, but we also have to own up to the problem set. The last point that I wanted to make is the idea of posing hard questions, which I think all of us have talked about here. And the hard questions that I think we really need to deal with is our underlying philosophies of war and war fighting. We need to establish what in our system stands up to intellectual rigor and what's living on due to the more often powerful explanation of parochialism and inertia. Because we've always done it that way is no longer a good excuse. Now, in some areas, and we used the metaphor was used of the emperor in new clothes earlier, sometimes we need to not only admit where the emperor has no clothes, but that the Pentagon's spending on wardrobe has gone awry. For example, the U.S. has spent more money on national ballistic missile defense than it did on the entire Apollo space program that took man to the moon. Now, even if the ultimate goal, and I'm not even going to go into how it's not yet achieved and may never be achieved, but even if we did achieve the ultimate goal with this system, we would still get an incredibly low payoff. That is, even if it ever worked, I believe that money is better spent on more flexible, better payoff options, like, for example, the Aegis system, that we can double task. Another example of this is we need to be willing to ask, what do new doctrines mean for existing planned programs? That is, we've got lots of interest and energy around something like air-sea battle doctrine, and yet it's fascinating how everything that existed and was planned for before air-sea battle doctrine wonderfully seems to fit into it. What doesn't fit into it and what needs to be trimmed? It's sort of the inverse of what Bob was talking about of the key priorities. There are certain systems, there are certain programs that don't fit, but instead we visualized the air-sea battle doctrine, this new thing, as a great way to keep on doing the old. In other cases, we're going to have to question how we organize ourselves. Instead of framing every choice around which programs overall to eliminate or not, we might want to do what's called budget wargaming. Ask if there's other alternative force mixes that give commanders a more effective toolkit and a wider set of contingencies. So, for example, when it comes to discussions of American air power, the question to me is not simply whether to buy the F-35 or not and what year, but rather what are the mixes that it would be most optimal in? And those mixes apply to both warfighting contingencies, but, of course, the budget equation. So what might a theater commander, say out in Pacific Command, do with a squadron of 13 F-35s versus 8 F-35s, 2 F-18 E Growler electronic warfare strike craft, 1 Global Hawk, and 4 MQ-9 Reaper systems? And let me be clear, system doesn't mean single plane. It means multiple planes, the ability to have 4 on station 24/7. And, oh, by the way, the extra $182 million that we would save. What's the difference between these two packages? Which one's more attractive? Not just from a budget standpoint, but from an operational standpoint. Next issue, we need to be willing to look outside the boxes, particularly how we think about jointness, not only in the services, but with our foreign partners. We talk about programs like the Joint Strike Fighter as being joint, but they're not truly joint. Similarly, we talk about exploring joint bases, but we're clearly not there yet. We need to push this forward to a finer level of detail, and everything from joint training to joint postings to actual pooling of resources. If Britain and France can figure out how to do this, I think America and our close allies, like Britain, like Australia, et cetera, can figure out how to do this. It doesn't mean dropping the capability completely, but recognizing that there are certain areas where nations can jointly gain while facing their own budget crises. pooling resources or areas, particularly to explore in things like anti-submarine warfare, air defense, electronic warfare, search and rescue, countermine warfare, et cetera. Another set of these tough questions we need to pose is challenging cherished assumptions that might no longer stand up. So we're presently engaged in a fairly draining counterinsurgency. And the Army, while it's facing personnel cuts, still is resetting itself for a future that mixes counterinsurgency with more traditional missions of combined arms maneuver. And yet, the Army maintains 5,795 main battle tanks. The Marines have another 447. To put that number into context, it's roughly three times the number of tanks that we used in the Iraq War, the 1991 Iraq War, three times the size. Even the most ardent fans of tanks, and I'm one of them, don't contemplate any major ground invasion being conducted in the same way as we did it back in 1991, let alone three times the size. And oh, by the way, we don't have the logistics to get them there, even if we wanted to. But finally, I think the biggest old assumption that we need to challenge is the way that we're unwilling to look at spending on nuclear weapons through any other lens than arms control and negotiations with the loser of the Cold War. We spend $25 billion annually on maintaining some 5,500 nuclear warheads spread out across the nuclear triad that too many in this town, on both right and left, treat like the Holy Trinity, unwilling to question it. Whether it's shaving off 275 or 550 more warheads from this, and the accompanying roughly 1.25 to 2.5 billion a year you would save just by those shavings, the result, I would argue, would be no great strategic loss to the United States, but rather a strategic gain by the other parts of the defense budget and the research and development that we might be more effectively spending on. Again, I'm not talking about the traditional left-wing narrative of get rid of all the nukes, let's go down to zero. I love nukes. I just don't think we need 5,000 of them in any conceivable scenario, including alien attack. Rather, we have to be willing to think differently, to ask, what additional security does that 5,226 nuclear weapon buy me that I couldn't spend on something more effective on our military, on our national security? So to me, the bottom line of all of this, where we are right now, is goes back to that Churchill quote. We've got to think differently. We've got to now really get to asking the hard questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And if strategy is about making tough choices, I'm going to make one, which is, unfortunately, no Q&A for this panel. You'll have to save your questions for the congressman and for the second panel because, again, not only are we out of money, we're out of time, and so we're going to have to proceed. Please remember to stay where you are as we make the transition to Congressman Thornberry, but please also join me in thanking this distinguished panel.